The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Hypertension is presented by Dr. John Pryor.
All right, so hypertension. How many here take care of people with hypertension? Everybody. Who doesn't take care of people with hypertension? There's very few people that don't take care of hypertension. So this isn't meant to be an exhaustive review, because this is meant to be sort of an update to tell you what's going on with hypertension and what are important for the boards. So y'all know that it's really common and is increasing in incidence because we're aging and because we're getting bigger. So my wife tells me all the time. The old saw was that it's poorly controlled. We do a crappy job. I'll show you some data about that. We don't do such a crappy job anymore. It's the most common risk for cardiovascular disease. And if you look at in the world, why people die, they die of strokes and heart attacks. And if you look at the most common reason why they get strokes and heart attacks, it's hypertension. So it's the most common risk factor for disability adjusted life score, life years, which is what DALY is. So it's the most important thing that we have. And despite poor control, we've actually shown that each decade we go by, we have less and less people dying of cardiovascular disease and strokes. So we must be doing something. Well, the something is we've been coming out with these damn reports. And they started at six pages, and then they went to 13 pages, then they went to 30 pages, and then they went to 47 pages, then they went to 36 pages. And then they had some common sense, and they said, we're going to make this simple. Let's make it 14 pages, right? So if you know that the JNC8 is 14 pages as far as the guidelines. Now, what I'm sure you also know is that JNC8 was so damn controversial that the American Heart Association published their own guidelines along with the CDC, and the American Society of Hypertension published their own guidelines along with the International Society of Hypertension. And England, with NICE, published their own guidelines. So unfortunately, even though it's only 14 pages, now we have 14 guidelines to tell us what to do with hypertension. So first off, we know is that it's more common in men than women, and that's what these show. And it's more common as you get older than as we age, we have a higher incidence of hypertension, and it's more—it's higher in African Americans than it is in any other population that we have. So it's not strictly an African American problem, but it's certainly more of a problem than in the other populations. The other thing about Black African American hypertension is a totally different actor in a lot of ways. So there's a couple definitions you have to know. Primary hypertension is your pressure. You meet criteria for hypertension, but you don't have any other reason, and you have no signs that you have malignant hypertension, which I'll show you what that is. White coat hypertension is blood pressure high in the office, but not high at home. Mass hypertension is a group of, so mass hypertension is somebody who's got severe LVH or on echocardiogram, but yet their pressure when they see you is normal. There actually are some people that have hypertension that's higher at home than it is in your office. Secondary hypertension means that we have another reason for it. Malignant or accelerated hypertension is a very specific diagnosis, okay? Specific based on eye grounds, okay? Malignant and accelerated hypertension say that you have to have grade 3 or 4 hypertensive eye grounds, and it's according to the Keith and Wagner classification, which looks at acute hypertension, and I'll show you a picture of that. Resistant hypertension is you're on 3 drugs, one of them a diuretic, and your pressure is above goal. Some people lose 160 as their goal, but it's above goal. That's resistant hypertension. This is what grade 3 and 4 eyes look like. In the center, you can see there's papilledema. The upper left-hand side, that's a hemorrhage. And then if you look down further, there's another hemorrhage at about 5 o'clock, and at 3 o'clock, there's an exudate. So these are hemorrhages and exudates. So if you have hypertension and these eyes, you have malignant or accelerated hypertension. Nobody else has malignant or accelerated hypertension unless you have these eyes. It's a very specific diagnosis. A hypertensive emergency is if you have hypertension plus you have end organ dysfunction, whether it be a dissection of an aneurysm, whether it be you're having an MI, whether it be you having heart failure. And it has nothing to do with what the level is, and it has nothing to do with what your eyes look like. Malignant hypertension is a type of hypertensive emergency. Hypertensive urgency is what we see the most of, and it's just your pressure is more than 180. A non-dipper, so blood pressure typically dips when you go to sleep. About 20 to 40% of people with hypertension don't dip, and that actually predicts worse outcomes than blood pressure control. So identical blood pressures, one doesn't dip, one dips. The person who doesn't dip is more likely to have heart attacks and strokes, so it picks out a high-risk population. Gestational hypertension is a pressure more than 140 over 90, and it occurs after the 20th week in pregnancy. So here's where we were. So as if you guys have all seen, the one of the best things that we've had about population studies is the NHANES. NHANES is a wonderful study that every 5 years comes out with new outcomes. And what we know is, and what's they've always harped at us, they always say you do a crappy job of identifying blood pressure, you do a crappy job of controlling blood pressure, and this is what they were talking about. Yeah, so as of 2000, what you can see is that every decade that we go up, more people are aware that they have hypertension, so we're doing a pretty good PR job. The current data is 82%, so we've gone from 70% to 82% as of 2012. As far as how many of those people are treated, we've gone from 31% of them are treated up to 60%, and the current data now says 75% of those people are treated. So 75% of those people that have been diagnosed with hypertension are treated. How well are they controlled? The current data says we're 52%. So we went from 10% in the 70s to 34% in the 1990s. We are currently at 52%. So 52% of our patients are treated to goal. So not so bad as they make it out to be. I mean, they make it out to be like we're these horrible people that don't take a good care of blood pressure. And actually, if you look at those people that are treated, about 70% of them are at goal. So we actually don't do a bad job. So I think one of the things, yes, there is, what we've seen is that over the past 5 years or so, this is plateaued. We're not getting any better. But we, I think actually, look at what happened from 1976 on, we've done a lot better than we used to. And because of this, we've seen that there's a decreased incidence of strokes. And if you look at the average percent reduction, it's 35 to 40%. And even MIs, and even heart failure. So heart failure, you get, for hypertension control, heart failure gives you the most bang for your buck, and then stroke, and then MIs. So hypertension control seems to do best for heart failure, second best for strokes, and second and third best for MIs. So how do you evaluate people? I think you guys all know how to evaluate them. It's just really a history and physical examination, as well as some directed laboratory studies. And then assessment of cardiovascular risk. I usually, anybody that's got hypertension, I usually do either the ATP3 risk score or I do a Framingham risk score to assess what their cardiovascular, risks are of MI in the next 10 years. And these are the recommendations. They say electrocardiogram and urinalysis. I don't do an EKG because I think it's kind of worthless. We all do urinalysis. We all do sugars on these people. We all will check a potassium. We'll all check kidney function. I think a lipid profile is very valuable in this group of people because it does change risk. And I personally, as a nephrologist, screen everybody with a urinary albumin to creatinine ratio because I think that that tells me end organ damage and changes my goals. And then if you come up with positives in this, then you come up, then you'll go on and work them up for secondary hypertensions. The other thing that I think we don't recognize, there's two things I think we don't recognize. One is that how many people take blood pressures in both arms when they come into the office for the first time? The difference between, if you have more than a 10 millimeter difference in blood pressure between the two sides, it doubles your risk for heart attack. Okay, so you can just do that simple test and you can tell what their cardiovascular risk is simply by saying there's more than 10 millimeters difference. Also, obviously predicts risk for peripheral vascular disease. Second thing is, how many of you guys have patients that come in and their pressure is 120 over 70 one time and 160 over 70 the next time and then 140 over 70, that their blood pressure varies all the time? So those people actually are at higher risk for cardiovascular outcome, poor cardiovascular outcome than those people that come in with uncontrolled hypertension every time. Blood pressure variability, arm variability, people that don't dip at night are the predictors for severe vascular disease. So those are things you can pick up in the office that will predict what's going to happen to your patient. Ambulatory blood pressure mounted, I'm not going to really go too much farther. I mean, we really only do it for those people that have what we think is white coat hypertension. But I teach all my patients to do self-monitoring of blood pressure because it beats the hell out of my office blood pressures. So people that come in to me and I check their blood pressures, I will always ask them to get a cuff if they can afford it. I will always counsel them as far as how to use the cuff and what size cuff that they should have. And we will usually typically calibrate their cuffs so they can measure their blood pressures at home. And I think that that means a lot to me, a lot more to me than anything that I get in the office. Why are people uncontrolled when they come to see you? It could be that you're using too small a cuff. It could be you don't wait for 5 minutes between the times you check them. So if you look at when they've done studies for hypertension, you have to look and see how long they waited before they checked the blood pressure in these studies, because if they didn't wait 5 minutes, in general, blood pressure is 10 millimeters higher if they didn't wait. If they take the blood pressure immediately versus waiting 5 minutes, there's a 10 millimeter difference. So that's important. Inadequate diuretic therapy, I think that Mark and I would both agree that hypertension in kidney disease especially is really sensitive to diuretics, and attention to detail and diuretics are really important in these patients. And I think sometimes what you find is people use other drugs and they drink more than 14 drinks a week for men, and those are other reasons for hypertension. But in general, with resistant hypertension, the reason that's an important group is that they tend to have a higher incidence of secondary hypertension than the general population. If you look at patients, most populations say that resistant hypertension occurs about 1 in 10 of your patients. And if you look at nephrology patients, the chronic kidney disease patients, it occurs probably 20 to 30% of our CKD patients have resistant hypertension. So CKD is a big risk factor for it. But it happens about 1 in 10 of your patients, so you can't control. All right, so what are the other causes of hypertension? So chronic kidney disease and hypertension is probably the most common secondary hypertension that we get. And what this is a graph of what happens to your blood pressure as your kidney function gets worse. And as your kidney function gets worse, your blood pressure gets higher. And by the time you have a GFR of 15 or less, the incidence of hypertension is 75%. And the incidence of severe hypertension is 20%. So as your kidney function gets worse, the incidence of hypertension goes up. You know, by the time you hit dialysis, by the time my patients hit dialysis, almost all of them are hypertensive. And if you looked at what happens in kidney disease, like they can't walk, they have low calciums, they can be anemic and stuff like that, nowhere near how much hypertension. So the bar, the lavender bar on these graphs here and here compared to there, if you look at those, the worse your kidneys are, the more likely you are to have hypertension. It's the most common additional complication that we see in our patients. And some patients have more hypertension than others that have kidney disease. I talked a lot about GNs today. My GNs tend to have a lot more hypertension than the rest of the kidney population. And it's the pathogenesis is a few different things. I talked about salt sensitivity. That's really important. As your GFR decreases, salt sensitivity goes up, and you really have to make sure that this is a typical low renin hypertension where their volume expanded and you have to get rid of volume and salt to help control that. So if you have somebody that's got CKD and their blood pressure is out of control, look at your diuretics first, second, and third, especially if they're proteinuric and they have CKD. Uric acid is it's an interesting thing. It's high in a lot of my patients, and physiologically it causes abnormalities, but we've never been able to prove that it does anything, with the exception of a couple small studies, one looking at stable angina that said if you treat uric acid, they can walk further, and two, a small group of people that have hypertension, if you treat uric acid, it gets better. But I don't treat asymptomatic hyperuricemia, but it's an interesting thing to consider in the future. And then there's a cool thing which I like, is so we always say that hypertension, essential hypertension, is genetic, and that's kind of cool. It is. Like, we've seen genetic abnormalities, but think back to when you took care of people moms that were hypertensive, what size were their babies? Their babies were small. What size were their babies' kidneys? Their kidneys were small. They had small nephrons. So small babies beget small kidneys, beget small nephrons, which cause hypertension. So maybe it's not just a genetic disease. It might also be by the fact that you've mom's babies that have that are hypertensive during it are small for gestational age. So why do we care about hypertension? Well, this is a thing that looks at change in GFR versus blood pressure. And you can see in both of these, the better your blood pressure control is, the less you change your GFR. The better your blood pressure, the less you change GFR. We don't like GFR to change. We're happy to have GFR stay the same. So I know that in any population I've taken care of that has CKD, if I make their blood pressure better, they're going to slow progression of disease and their kidneys will last longer. And I dialyze and I make a living by dialyzing, but I make a living by not trying to prevent people from going on dialysis, really. That's what I prefer to do. So we know for sure the first thing you can do for hypertension for people that have kidney disease is control their blood pressure. Because if you do, their kidneys will last longer. And this is no more true than it is in diabetics. So these are things that looked at interventions in diabetes to see how many people you had to treat to save one kidney. And if you remember, this is the captopril study. This is intense insulin coverage. And this is the ibisartan trial, which looked at type 2 diabetics. If you look at that, if you control their blood pressure with an ACE or an ARB, you actually need to treat less people than you need to treat their diabetes. So even though we focus a lot on diabetic control, I hate to say it, it's blood pressure control and use of ACE inhibitors that save more kidneys than diabetic control. Now, albeit these people all probably had structural kidney disease by the time they were intervened on. And the worse your kidneys, the better you get. So this just shows that the lower blood pressure you do with the worse kidneys, the better you're going to do. So the worse the kidneys, the worse the proteinuria, the better blood pressure is going to positively influence you. And this was a study that looked at people with stage 4 chronic kidney disease and showed that the higher the ACE inhibitor, the better you did. So the top number where the benzopril was the highest dose of benzopril versus the next dose. And this is people that had stage 3 kidney disease, and they showed that the higher the ACE. So ACEs really matter in my patients. So the efficacy in non-diabetics, we've shown that in stage 3, the absolute risk reduction for doubling of creatinine or need for dialysis is 8 to 10%. The number needed to treat is 10 to 11. Can you imagine? What things do we have that we can treat 10 to 11 people and all positively influence their outcomes? Not many. And if their kidney function is stage 4, the absolute risk reduction is 20%. The number needed to treat is 5. So there's not many things that I can treat 5 people and get one good outcome out of. I mean, so that's actually real. So the worse the kidneys, the worse the proteinuria, the better, the worse the hypertension, the better they do with these drugs. So we can't be any stronger in endorsing use of ACE inhibitors with CKD. With a proviso. So the proviso is if you have the worse the kidney function is, the more careful you have to be. So one, if your GFR is less than 30, we typically start with half the usual starting dose because most of these drugs are cleared by the kidney. Two, we repeat labs in a defined period of time. 2 weeks if your GFR is less than, you know, in two weeks if your GFR is less than 30. In 4 weeks if it's less than 60. And we will continue the drug unless their GFR has dropped by 30% or their potassium has increased by 5.5. So yes, you can use these drugs. You have to just be careful with using these drugs. There is no GFR that I won't use these drugs on, including people on dialysis. So how about renal vascular hypertension? That used to be the one big topic that people had all the time. And it was a big topic in our population, in our hospital, because the cardiologists were running out of coronary arteries to stent. And so they used to do these things called drive-by angiograms. On their way up to do the coronaries, they would look at squirt the renal arteries, and they say, oh, there's some blockage here, let me fix them. And you know, the problem is we didn't have the data to say what we should. But we always knew that renal vascular disease was one of the secondary causes, and it was usually in abnormal ages. We oftentimes would hear a brewery They had really bad blood pressure. Matter of fact, if you're a 50-year-old guy and you had malignant hypertension, your incidence of renal artery stenosis was 30 to 40%. So the worse the blood pressure, we would see it sometimes. And oftentimes we might see a unilateral kidney or those people that would come in with flash pulmonary edema with pressures of 240 over 140. And so we would screen them a lot, and we would do Dopplers, and we would do MRIs, and we would do CT angiograms. And what we found was the CT angiogram is probably the best test, close with an MRI, although most people, a lot of my patients don't like to lay down for that time to get the MRI, and we could get the same information. But then, how do you diagnose them? Well, we could the best way to diagnose them was angiographically. And unfortunately, in my hospital, they were doing drive-by angios, and that's how they were diagnosing. And they got these beautiful little pictures, and they would kind of go in and they say, look, I have a blockage here, and I fixed it. Is that okay? You heard he did it. Why are you asking my permission to do this? So, and this is an osteostenosis with the same type of problem. Well, lo and behold, Medicare... Well, I'll show you the Medicare statistics, but lo and behold, we had a lot of question about whether it was worth to do it. So the first thing that we were able to do, the first trial that was able to be published was this thing called the ASTRAL trial. And what this did is it looked at systolic and diastolic blood pressure with intervention or without intervention. Can you tell a difference? Not me. So why am I intervening? Here's what happened. We're going to save kidneys, so this will make it better. Here's the serum creatinine. Is there any difference in the two? There's no difference. So why am I intervening in people with renal artery stenosis? So there was, and if I looked at total outcomes, the total outcomes were exactly the same. So there was a question there that people said, well, maybe you didn't do the study right. And the cardiologists kept doing, and the interventionalists kept doing it. You can see that we went from 7,600 to 35,000 by 2005. And so in fine CMS fashion, CMS said, we will sponsor a trial to answer this question one and all. And it's called the CORAL trial. And the CORAL trial was actually a really well-done trial that looked at a good medical side along with the intervention side. And so good that if you weren't diabetic, 93% of the people were controlled medically. And if you were diabetic, they got up to 80%. Remember I told you we're talking 50, 60% in the general population. This is the best we do. And they're going to follow them up for a couple of years. And lo and behold, what did they show? They showed that there's no difference. And this is a forest plot. And you can see this is the line of identity on both sides. Can you see anything that doesn't cross the line? Everything crosses the line. There's no difference. So the only thing I'll leave you with is, again, we're going to go back to the ACE. This is a small study, but it's an important study that shows that if you give people ACE inhibitors that have renal artery stenosis, they actually do better. Even though a lot of times you'll hear that, oh, I don't want to give it to them, they might have bilateral renal artery stenosis, they actually do better. They live longer and they have less progression of their renal disease. So we don't recommend angioplasty at all for renal artery stenosis, but we recommend that all of our patients that can tolerate it be on an ACE inhibitor. So, number one principle is don't poke the skunk. And number two principle is use ACEs and ARBs in as many people as you can for this. Primary aldosteronism. So this is people that came to me. They weren't actually people that came to me, I'm lying, but they're people that came in because they have resistant hypertension. And they gave people a simple intervention for the resistant hypertension. They put them on 25 or 50 milligrams of spironolactone. I never get this kind of number with any kind of antihypertensive. At 6 weeks, you're down by 20 millimeters. At 3 months, you're down by 23. By 6 months, you're down by 25. We never see this. So that's kind of interesting. Spironolactone is extremely, people that have resistant hypertension are very responsive to spironolactone. So keep that in mind for your own population. But it also tells you that maybe this population of people with resistant hypertension oftentimes will have primary aldosteronism as one of the etiologies. And in most referral centers, it's about 20%. So if you have resistant hypertension, there's about a 20% risk that you have primary aldosteronism. And maybe that's part of the reason spironolactone works so well. And if you look at how severe your hypertension is, it's even worse. So the worse your blood pressure, and if you have resistant hypertension, then the more likely you are to have primary aldosteronism. So Mark and I had a little bit different numbers as far as screening, but the way we screen is we'll do a plasma renin and a plasma aldosterone. And if the ratio between aldo to renin. If the aldo to renin ratio is more than 30 to 1, that's considered to be 90 to 95% sensitive and specific for this disease, especially if the aldo is high. Okay, so that's an easy screen. Now, the proviso is they can't be on any, so you can't have them on spironolactone or allopurinol. So you can't have them on aldosterone antagonist when you do the test, but they can continue any other drug. And then they might, and then to confirm it, they'll do 24-hour urines. I happen to personally stop at this point because most of my patients I see are not going to be surgically correctable. And really, all I want to know is that that's what it is, and so I can titrate spironolactone. But some, and most of my patients have hyperplasia, so they're not surgical candidates either. So in that case, but at that point, I usually stop after the plasma renin to aldo ratio. And that's a little nice little thing that shows an aldosteronoma. Okay. All right. So again, I think I probably harped on this before. The most important stroke risk factor is hypertension by a long stretch. And if you think of, so I was showing you with kidney disease, we do a pretty damn good, I mean, if we give people certain drugs like angiotensin receptor blockers and ACE inhibitors, our number needed to treat is pretty low. But if you're going to treat a, if you're going to do this as primary prevention to prevent things for stroke prevention, I have to treat about 8,000 people with this. Now, if you look at that, compare that to statins, I do a better job in statins and we do a better job even than aspirin, the current aspirin data. So you gotta treat a lot of people if you're also treating as primary hypertension. But if you're trying to prevent people, the number drops down into a reasonable thing. So somebody who's had a stroke before, treatment of hypertension is really impressive as far as prevention. Lifestyle modifications, I mean, we espouse this in our patients. I will personally say that I don't espouse it in my own self. I'm not very good at doing lifestyle modifications. And I don't know why, because diet and hypertension really works. But this is the real why, is that it's not durable. So pretty much everybody gets a good response at 6 and 8 weeks, but then after 6 months to a year, it wears off because people are tired of eating a DASH diet and they're tired of exercising 40 minutes four times a day. And the second, another thing to know is that, so you start people on monotherapy for hypertension. What you have to know is that in general, if you look at all hypertension, it takes between 2 and 3 drugs to control hypertension. So don't be frustrated if you start somebody on a single drug and their blood pressure is not controlled. This is just a quick warning about beta blockers and thiazides, which will increase your risk for diabetes. Okay, and then finally, we're gonna go through a quick update. So quick update is a few different things that we can kind of go through and talk about what the current literature says about treatment of hypertension. So on target was ACE plus ARB versus ARB in people that are high cardiovascular risk. You can see that's pretty much a straight line. So the addition of an ACE and ARB are not recommended because there's no additional benefit. And it, what they don't show you is that the incidence of acute kidney injury and hyperkalemia is higher if you add the two together. So most people, everybody agrees ACE and ARBs together are not worthwhile and they're dangerous. Which is what we said. Simplicity was pretty cool. When it came out, I thought, man, this is gonna be cool. This will be a way to satisfy our cardiologists, because I'm telling them they're not allowed to do my renal arteries anymore, but they could stick a fancy catheter up into the renal arteries and ablate the sympathetic nervous system. And remember, I was telling you these 22 and 25s that I saw with aldosterone, and I was telling you how much they were. So this was the first trial when they did this and showed this. And they went through 2 other trials, including a sham trial, and what they showed was it doesn't work. So the last trial was actually really good medical treatment versus this, and really good medical treatment plus a sham intervention, and showed that there was no difference in outcome. So at least at this point, renal sympathetic denervation is sort of lost its luster, and people don't advocate doing that. Now, in fine cardiology tradition, they've said, well, it seems like it helps obstructive sleep apnea and it helps heart failure, so we'll continue to do it. We'll find another indication for it. But they haven't, so far, as far as nephrologists, no. This is where all of us get a headache. And this is a quick summary of the current guidelines. So all the guidelines agree that you should use ACE/ARB, thiazides, calcium channel blockers as first line. You should only use beta blockers and aldactone for second for people who fail. They all agree that African Americans should patients should be on thiazides or calcium channel blockers. They all agree that you shouldn't use an ACE and an ARB together, and they all agree that ACEs and, well, at least the JNC8 says that you should use ACEs in all people with CKD. As far as the goals, that's the problem. The problem is that if you look at the people with JNC8, they say if you're 60 years old or older, your blood pressure only has to be less than 150. All of them agree if you're more than 80, you should be less than 150. If you're between 60 and 80 years old, the JNC8 doesn't agree, but yet American Society of Hypertension and as well as the American Heart Association feel that people should be less than 140. And then people that are less than 60, they all think that it should be less than 140. And if you have CKD and albuminuria, we think you should be less than 130. Now, that's nice, but I'm going to show you a trial that kind of blows that out of the water. So this is an important trial. This is the ASH trial, and this looked at African-American hypertension, which is a different hypertension than everybody else, and it's probably because of genetic mutations of apolipoprotein A1. So oftentimes in the African-American population, there is various mutations of apolipoprotein A1, sometimes two mutations, sometimes one mutation, and this alters how kidneys act, and this alters how hypertension acts. And those people that have this mutation don't respond to hypertension control like everybody else. And in addition, their kidneys fail quicker than everybody else. And this is really a busy slide, but you really pay attention to the bottom right-hand corner, which shows that they looked at 120 versus 140, and 120 was no better than 140 for African Americans. So we can sort of take that with a grain of salt and say maybe in African Americans, maybe we shouldn't be as aggressive as far as blood pressure control. The ACCORD trial, you all know about that. They're diabetics. None of them have kidney disease. We look at 120 versus 140. What they found was 120 did as well as 140. So in diabetics that don't have kidney disease, 140 is just as good. However, I would call your attention to the lower line here. If I had my druthers, I'd rather not have a stroke. Stroke incidence markedly decreased, and the p-value was very significant. Again, these are just things that show the same thing. And then finally, the SPRINT trial. And the SPRINT trial is really what sort of threw the wrench into everything, right? So So what is the SPRINT trial? The SPRINT trial took people that had hypertension and were moderate to high risk cardiovascular disease. So if they did an ATP3 or they did a Framingham risk score and you had hypertension, you could enter into the trial. You were not allowed to have polycystic kidney disease. You could not have had a previous stroke, and you weren't allowed to be diabetic. Okay, but that's a good percentage of my patients. I mean, this would be patients I see. They randomized you to 120 versus 140, okay? And what they showed across everybody was that they actually stopped the trial early because 120 was much better than 140. So here we have these JNC8 guidelines and different guidelines that are telling us that we should make people less than 140 and sometimes less than 150, but the SPRINT trial, which looked at a group of people that had all comers. I mean, so they had CKD. A lot of them were elderly. They showed that 120 was better than 140 for all the outcomes included. So I think that that's where we're left with right now. What do you do about your patients? So my approach has been I don't follow the 60-year-old JNCH guidelines. I follow the American Society of Hypertension that says my first goal is going to be them to be less than 140. And then I'm going to decide, are they moderate or high risk for cardiovascular disease? If they're moderate to high risk of cardiovascular disease, I'm going to attempt to take them lower. The older you are, I will still attempt that, but I will do that with the proviso. And the proviso is those people have to get blood pressure sitting and blood pressure standing every time they come to see me. Because what I don't want to do is make their blood pressure too low and have them fall over and break a hip. So that's my group. For kidney patients, my goal is 120. My goal is 120 in kidney patients, so especially if you have proteinuria. So, I mean, I can understand. I mean, it's tough. I think this world of hypertension with all these damn guidelines drive me absolutely cruddy. So I prefer to follow the SPRINT trial and follow those guidelines and try to make my patients 120 if I think it's appropriate, if I think it's high-risk population. If I'm doing primary prevention, that's a different story, but if I'm doing secondary prevention because of high risk where they have CKD, then I'm going to go for the 120.